like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's been a very interesting conference so far. I was also asked to give a talk, and the only topic I could think of which would be related to the event horizon was this one. So essentially, what I will be trying to do is to explain how the Blanton-Dunaik mechanism works and how the event horizon, what role the event horizon plays in this mechanism, if any at all. And I will start with this result by Wald. And what he did, he considered a Kerr black hole and a vacuum solution for the electromagnetic field in the space-time of this black hole. And one ingredient of this solution is a magnetic field, which is aligned with the symmetry axis of the black hole. And another ingredient is the electric field. So this black hole has not only magnetic field in its neighborhood, but also the electric field. You can call this electric field gravitationally induced. And the interesting thing about this gravitationally induced electric field, which I denote here by letter D, is that there is a non-vanishing component along the magnetic field. And this result inspired Blanton-Dunaik to do their seminal work. And essentially, they first estimated what would be the strength of this electric field, of this component, for the typical conditions of the supermassive black holes. And they found that it's very strong. In fact, it's so strong that it can accelerate particles to very high energies. And eventually, well, this will trigger Copious pair production in the magnetosphere. So, well, the space around the black hole will be filled by plasma. Okay, and then they decided to construct, to look for plasma solutions for the magnetosphere in the same way as it's done for pulsars. And they managed actually to find those solutions, asymptotic perturbative solutions for a slowly rotating black hole. And this was a very interesting solution. So first of all, the magnetosphere was rotating, and the energy from the black hole was extracted in the form of the Poynting flux flowing away from the black hole. But there is a big difference with a neutron star that we know what drives the current in the case of the neutron star. Essentially, it's the J cross B force on the surface. On the surface of this conductor. But in the case of the black hole, we do not have such surface. So we do not have, well, this J cross B force, which drives, well, the currents across the magnetic field lines. Okay, so how actually, well, this, the whole thing works. What actually drives the current? What is the inductor in this case? Well, that was the questions of the interpretation of this solution. And McDonald and Horner proposed, well, the following solution. They proposed to consider, well, the event horizon, or actually a sort of surface very close to the event horizon, as an inductor of the Blanton-Dunaik mechanism, with a distributed charges over the surface, currents flowing over the surface. So everything looking just in exactly the same way as in the case of the neutron stars. And eventually, well, this resulted in the so-called membrane paradigm. Later, Pansley and Karaniti, well, heavily criticized, well, this picture. And the key point of this criticism is very simple. So event horizon is actually causally disconnected from the space outside of the black hole. So everything can only fall into the black hole through the event horizon. Right? Nothing can escape. And there's also concluded that the Blanton-Dunaik solution must be non-causal and unstable. And the argumentation was the following. So in this solution, Blanton-Dunaik imposed a particular boundary condition on the event horizon. or at least this is what they understood as a boundary condition. Okay? And Pünsli once again argued, that you cannot impose a boundary condition on the event horizon because the event horizon is not causally connected with the outside world. Okay? So it cannot affect the solution outside of the event horizon. And instead, they proposed an alternative, very attractive alternative MHD mechanism. And within their theory, what was happening can be described as following. So the magnetic field pushes plasma inside the ergosphere of the black hole onto orbits with negative energy at infinity. And when mechanical energy at infinity, yes? And when those particles are fall into the black hole, they will carry in all this negative energy. Okay, and this is how there is energy at infinity of the black hole is extracted in this mechanism. So this can be called, well, the MHD Penrose process, because it's very similar to the Penrose process, right? In the Penrose process, well, particles with negative energy fall into the black hole, yes, and the particle with positive energy flow away from the black hole. Okay, so however, Earl, when the time came to do numerical simulations, but it became possible to do numerical simulations. The first one that was by me in 2001, so I solved time-dependent solutions of this phosphory electrodynamics for the split monopole configuration of the magnetic field. And it turned out that the Blanford-Naik solution was absolutely perfect. It was asymptotically stable from some quite arbitrary initial configuration. It evolved towards the steady-state solution of Blanford-Naik. And later, MHD simulations were carried out in a similar fashion. Now, the particles had inertia, and you could check whether they were pushed into the orbits with negative energy and infinity or not, and it turned out they were not. And the MHD solutions were very close to the Blanford-Naik solution and completely disagreed with the Pünsli and Karaniti theory. And so, well, we are back to the square one. So how do we understand the Blanford-Naik result, Blanford-Naik mechanism? OK, and I will try to explain it, well, in very simple terms. And I'll start with the equations of Maxwell's electrodynamics. And that's the case of a flat space time. And we use particular inertial frame in order to write down these equations. And we have two groups, well, the Faraday group and the Maxwell group of the equations. And they involve, well, these four vector fields, B, E, D, and H. And, it's not enough just to have those equations. In order to have a closed system, we also need some additional constitutive equations which relate all those four vector fields. And those constitutive laws describe the properties of material. And in vacuum and in plasma, well, B equals H and D equals E. If we move to the to the black holes, to the electrodynamics of black holes, then it turns out that you can write down 3+1 equations of this electrodynamics in exactly the same form as the equations of the Maxwell, as Maxwell's equations in matter. So the same B, E, D, and H fields. And from the 3+1 split of the space-time, you can easily derive all those constitutive equations which relate those four vector fields. Here, alpha is known as a Laplace function. And beta is the shift vector of the space-time foliation. Okay, so the only difference, one significant difference here is that if you ask an observer at rest in the space of this foliation what is their magnetic and electric field, then it will tell you that, B is my magnetic field and my electric field is in fact D, not E. Okay. Right. So overall, well, you can summarize this picture is that, well, the curved space-time of the black hole acts as an exotic electromagnetically active material. Okay, now if you use these equations, then you can easily derive a number of very interesting results. Well, first of all, you can show that, well, axisymmetric steady-state poloidal magnetic field always induces non-vanishing electric field. So, well, we start with this Faraday equation and this constitutive equation, and consider that I'm independent case where this derivative vanishes, so we end up with this equation. So now let's assume that there is no electric field. So D is zero. Then beta cross B must be a potential field. And therefore, if you integrate this along a closed loop, the result should be zero. Okay, so then if you just take a loop centered on the symmetry axis, then you can rewrite this integral, contour integral in this form, where a phi is a phi component of the vector potential of the magnetic field, and omega f is the angular velocity of the fiducial observer. Well, here I'm using, well, the Boyle-Lindquist coordinates, where the shift vector is given in this form. So it has only the phi component. Now, if you look at this result, well, this contour integral must be zero. Right, how can it be zero? Only if omega phi is a function of omega f is a function of a phi. Or the other way around, a phi is a function of omega f. Okay, but a phi essentially gives you the magnetic flux function. And in the case of axisymmetry, it must be constant on the symmetry axis. Because a magnetic field cannot cross the symmetry axis. Yes, it can be only a line is the symmetry axis. And therefore, a phi must be constant along the symmetry axis, but the angular velocity of the fiducial observer is not. Well, we know this. It's not constant, and then how can this be satisfied? Only if a phi is actually constant throughout the whole space. And therefore, the magnetic field is zero. The poloidal magnetic field is zero. And, well, the valid solution is one particular example of this, well, general result. Okay, right. So we have, well, this, which I can call gravitationally induced electric field. And the next question is, well, can this gravitational field drive the electric currents of the Benford-Naik solution? Well, Pansley and Karaniti, well, they argued that, well, if you introduce charges into such electromagnetic field, then they will separate and screen out completely, well, this electric field. And therefore, it will not be able to drive the electric currents. But in fact, we can also show relatively straightforward that this vacuum electric field cannot be totally screened by a static distribution of electric charges. So what the total screening means? Well, first of all, there should not be a component of electric field along the magnetic field. Otherwise, it would be accelerated charges. So it would not be a static case. Yes. And second is that, well, the magnitude of this electric field must be smaller than the magnitude of the magnetic field. Otherwise, you can find a frame where all you have is just electric field. Okay, just by the Lorentz boost. And this electric field will be able to drive currents as well. So this will not be a static distribution either. And what they actually mean by static, well, it's written here. So first of all, the magnetosphere should not be, there should not be a rotation of this magnetosphere filled by this, well, static distribution of the charges, and there should not be poloidal current. And actually, from this condition, right, you can immediately conclude that along that the angular velocity of the magnetic field line should be constant. So this is just one particular case of this general result, that the angular velocity is actually zero. So if you use well, those two conditions, then you can end up with this result. You can find this result. So b squared minus d squared equals to, well, this. Okay, and here we have, well, this alpha squared minus beta squared. And this quantity can be negative and can be positive. And it's positive outside of the ergosphere, and it's negative inside of the ergosphere. Okay, and if it's negative inside the ergosphere, then the electric field is larger than the magnetic field. Okay, this means unscreened electric field. So this basically proves that indeed, well, you cannot have a static distribution of electric charges, which kills, well, this electric field. Okay, now, so you must have either rotation of the charges or poloidal currents or both of them. If you include rotation with non-zero angular velocity, obviously, yes, then this rotation introduces two light surfaces. Between of those light surfaces, the rotation will be subliminal, and outside of these light surfaces, the rotation will be superluminal. Okay? And in the superluminal regions, we always have D larger than B. And this basically comes from this result, this equation, general equation. So here we have, once again, B squared minus D squared. Here is B squared multiplied by the function which determines the light surfaces. And here we have a term which involves a poloidal current. So in the superluminal region, well, this function is negative. Okay? So here we have a negative quantity in this region. And how the whole thing can be positive if you want to have screen electric field? And only if the poloidal current is non-zero. Okay? So this tells you that you can have screening of this electric field on the marginal screening, which involves the poloidal current. Okay, so in the process of screening of this electric field, gravitation-induced electric field, poloidal current should be driven in the magnetosphere. So this should not be, as a case of the dead magnetosphere, it should be alive and active magnetosphere, just like in the case of a rapidly rotating neutron star. And it's interesting that the inner light surface, you can show it, it's always inside the ergosphere. And if the angular velocity of the magnetosphere is zero, then this surface coincides with the ergosphere. And if the angular velocity equals to the angular velocity of the black hole, then it coincides with the horizon. Okay, and the final question, which I'm going to address, is that is it possible to relate the Blanford-Znaik process with the Penrose process. Okay, so this, in order to discuss this, we need to discuss all the energy conservation law. And if you consider a fiducial observer and ask him about what is conserved and how it's conserved within a small laboratory, within the small local inertial frame of this observer, then he will tell you that the energy density must be given by this equation, and the Poynting flux must be given by this equation. However, when we discuss the extraction of energy from the black hole, we are dealing with the global conservation law. And the global conservation law involves completely different quantities. Now they are without the hats here. And these quantities, well, E called is the density of the energy at infinity, and well, this Poynting flux X without the hat is a flux density of energy at infinity. And only at infinity, well, those two quantities actually coincide. So this energy at infinity, in fact, is not an energy as measured by an observer at rest in space.
Yeah, okay.
Right. If you consider just force-free, steady-state, axisymmetric magnetosphere, then it's easy to relate those two Poynting fluxes. Poynting flux are as measured by the fiducial observer, and the Poynting flux of energy at infinity. And the other quantities involved here is the angular velocity of the magnetic field and the angular velocity of the fiducial observer. And you can see from this result that if the angular velocity of the magnetosphere is lower than the angular velocity of the local fiducial observer at this particular point, then those two fluxes are oppositely directed to each other. Okay? So, if a local observer sees, for example, in this region, a Poynting flux going into the black hole, then the Poynting flux of energy at infinity is pointing away from the black hole. So the inflow, on one hand, of the electromagnetic field inside the black hole and the outflow of the energy at infinity from the black hole. The angular velocity of the magnetosphere is less than that of the black hole, then this condition is always satisfied near the event horizon. So near the event horizon, we have exactly this situation of oppositely directed Poynting fluxes. Yeah, I'm going right there. Okay. So, right. And about the surface where omega equals to omega f, it separates the inflow and outflow zones. In the inflow zone, which is close to the black hole, we have S hat pointing inwards, and the outside of the surface, it points outwards. So this is a clear analogy with the Penrose process. So we have an inflow and outflow. And inflow brings inflow near the black hole corresponds to outflow of energy at infinity, and outflow outside of the surface corresponds also to the outflow of the energy at infinity. Okay, so you can say therefore that the using well this argument that the Blum-Fasnaic is the electromagnetic version of the Penrose process. Okay, so my time is running out. So I just mentioned only that recently Lasota and company, they developed all these arguments, and they presented them with a fully covariant space-time formulation. And also, I would mention another paper by Koide and Bader, who further developed all this idea of the energy counterflow. And actually, they've shown that at the event horizon, the Poynting flux of energy at infinity can be written as the energy density of energy at infinity multiplied by some vector v, which points inwards. And they interpreted this, this velocity vector can be interpreted as the velocity of the magnetic field lines. Okay, so. This is it. Yeah.
So in the immediately preceding talk by Heino, he argued that spin couldn't provide a second parameter in jet power. And of course, the Blum-Fasnaic process very clearly is powered almost exclusively by spin, plus how much flux you would load. And I was just wondering if you could comment on what your expectation would be, or could you envision a scenario in which the spin would become an unimportant parameter, or does that start to make a problem?
If it's not a the Poynting flux dominated outflow from the black hole, then what else can drive high relativistic outflows? Well, those are funnel jets. At the boundary of the funnels, they're not very fast. They cannot be highly relativistic. So that's, and because we know that the jets are highly relativistic, if Lorentz factors up to 20, right, that it must be, that those jets must be generated by the Blanford-Naik process inside the funnel.